I'm here with Bob Downey of Galen Healthcare, a Boston company. Bob, could you briefly tell me what your company does?
Sure. Galen is a company that provides both software and services related to implementing and maintaining electronic healthcare record systems. So they offer technical and professional services, things like training doctors and clinical staff, things like getting environments set up, like hardware and software. And then what I manage is the product side of things. We have a variety of solutions for hospitals and doctors' offices that allow them to see patients better and maintain their clinical records in a more complete way.
And your own role is as head engineer, chief of engineering?
I just recently got a promotion, but I'm the director of product development. That's my primary title, but I also currently serve as kind of the chief software architect. Hmm. If you can have a chief software architect in a company with, you know, 10 developers. But
So from the perspective then of architecture, you joined the company at very early stage. So were you the person that made the primary choices?
Yeah, I was the first software engineer at Galen. Galen was started as a consulting company. They didn't have a product development or software development team, so I was the one who started that. So yeah, I definitely sort of laid the groundwork and built off that.
So how many years ago was this?
2008 is when I started here.
And my understanding is your primary stack is .NET.
Almost exclusively .NET, yep.
Was that something you had worked with previously and that was why you chose to go down that route?
Yeah, I've been doing .NET since college. 2000, 2001 with whatever they call it, what was the original name of .NET?
It's before I got to it. I got to it in 2005.
They had a clever name for it that was related to COM, but yeah, I've been working with it for basically my entire career. Started off as a VB programmer, but very quickly transitioned into .NET.
That's what everyone says.
Yes, very quickly. As quickly as I possibly could.
So then 2008?
Yep.
You had to come up with some architectural choices.
Mm-hmm.
What influenced you?
Well, certainly my work at my previous company, where I also served as the chief architect, that was a startup that I helped start, and we were mostly a Microsoft stack. And I sort of cut my teeth on enterprise development there, sort of developed a body of patterns and practices that I kind of relied on. And as I was the only developer that was hired at Galen initially, I decided that that would be the best way to go forward, to sort of build on what I already knew.
So when you say a body of patterns and practices, what are you referring to?
Well, I mean, at that point, this was certainly before I started practicing any kind of quote-unquote solid code, but this was mostly related to rules of thumb and overall architecture of large systems. So the system that I was hired, or the product I was hired to develop, was a product that was a client-server technology. It was built, the communications between the client and the server were WCF, and I chose WCF primarily because of the flexibility of the bindings, and that was going to be something that I needed in this environment. But it was mostly related to sort of my reasoning and my choices for the stack were in large extent based on the work I had done on a advertising platform that I had worked on my previous company. So that was you could kind of think of that as a client-server architecture where you had one or more large-scale server farms that were delivering large volumes of advertising to computers all over the internet. This platform is delivering clinical information to large volumes of computers. And it was, kind of loosely based on that same idea of how to make scalable systems. So, to give you a concrete example, I tried to do everything as asynchronously as I could and keep things as loosely coupled as I could. So in the same way, when you have an ad impression that you're recording, you don't want to necessarily hit the database when you're recording that ad impression. That might not be a scalable way to do it. Databases tend to be an expensive and finite resource that are hard to scale out. So instead, you do some kind of queuing mechanism. You throw a message onto a queue, and you let that queue can pile up as much as you want, as long as you eventually process those things, depending on, how timely you need the data to be. So it was a lot of the experiences I had dealing with large amounts of load with finite resources to deal with those that influenced my sort of initial architectural decisions with the first product I worked on here at Galen.
So you also, as you say, you mentioned rules of thumb. Did this mainly come from your previous experiences, or was there a lot of theory from the books, the Fowler books, the Evans books?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I've Patterns of Enterprise Application Architecture was probably the first big patterns book I read. And I think I probably read that in, I want to say late 2002, early 2003. So this was probably my first job out of college. I was a sort of fledgling software engineer. And, you know, that's one of those books where if it's the first time you're exposed to that, it kind of changes your life. You're like, oh my God, I'm doing everything wrong. And hopefully you read a bunch of those books. You know, you're doing everything wrong over and over again. At least that means you're learning. But certainly that book was one of those books where you're like, God, I need to rethink the way that I write software. Mm. But then when you actually go to sit down and try to apply those patterns, it gets a little messy, and you have to kind of learn what works and what doesn't and balance that with, time constraints and the resources you have available to you. And so you end up kind of developing your own patterns that you know have worked well. And really that translates into developing your own libraries that you know have worked well. Nowadays there's lots and lots of open source projects that most people, if they're, for instance, starting to say, oh, I want to have a logging framework, you're probably not going to write your own logging framework.
You hope not.
Yes. You would go snag one. And that to some extent was true in the sort of 2002, 2003 timeframe too, but there were fewer of them. And there was probably no centralized place to get them. And certainly the communities around that time weren't necessarily as built out, at least in the .NET world. So using Fowler as an inspiration, you develop your own libraries. And honestly, I have libraries we use at Galen now that still are in some way or another based on the libraries that I wrote a decade ago. I mean, they've evolved quite a bit, but they're based on practices or patterns that I've validated in dozens or hundreds of applications, and I know they work, and I continue to use them, and I try to adapt them and move to the latest and greatest one I can, and adjust as I see fit. But once you've kind of found something that works, you sometimes stick with it.
I've done that myself. You see a particular way of separating your logic out, interfaces in this point, implementations, certain types of dependency injection, reuse, because you know it, you're comfortable with it. But one of the things you hit on, though, was it's great to sit down, read the book, read the theory, but when you come to try to apply it, it can go sideways very quickly. Mm-hmm. How do you handle that kind of scenario, especially when you're in a company with serious deadlines, financial implications? You know, I wish I could do it this way, but I'm not necessarily able to.
Yeah, I think, at least in terms of the deadline aspect of that, I think a lot of it has to do with setting expectations. I'm lucky enough where I am now, where, the people above me and the team surrounding me are very comfortable in the process that we use and in the way that we do our planning. So we don't actually ever, truly miss a deadline. If we say we're doing a release on this date, we're doing a release on this date because that's the date where our last sprint ends. And whatever's ready at that date, that's our release. I mean, that's kind of the whole point. And so we've set the expectation that releases will never slip, features slip. Mm. And so then it comes down to, all right, what's more important? Is the feature more important, or is getting the proper, quote-unquote, proper architecture in there more important? Mm. And that's a debate you're always going to have. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You could be doing, your own homegrown pattern, and that's still going to happen. So I think in that aspect, that sort of, in the game of do I do it right or do I hit my deadline, it's up to the individual features that you're trying to implement and that kind of impact on the business for that particular release that you need to judge.
Have you ever been in a scenario where you've intended to produce a particular type of architecture, but through accident or deadline, you've ended up with something that you know isn't what you wanted? Do you then deliberately take time to go back and fix it, or do you say, you know what, it works, leave it alone?
That's pretty much every piece of software I've ever written. I would hope, right? Because otherwise you're not learning anything new. So yes, I would say that whether or not you go back to fix it has a lot to do with how long you let it go. So we have some software here that, has been sort of out in the wild for multiple years. And it, looking back on the architecture we used, it's definitely not something I would ever do again, but it works, and it's tested by time rather than by automated tests, for instance, there's very little business case that I can make to go back to fix it. Certainly for greenfield development, we try to do it the right way now. Mm. And for development where, you can justify the percentage of time you're going to have to spend fixing it, by saying that it's going to allow you to iterate faster or you know, solve the business problems faster, then it is justified. I mean, I'm not a purist by, in any sense of the word. I try to make sure that the decisions I make are the right decisions from the business's point of view. Mm. And so even if a piece of code or an entire application really rubs me the wrong way, I gotta be able to have a business justification for changing it. Even if it's the ugliest code you've ever seen, if it's doing the job that it was meant to do, and we're making money on it, and it's not inhibiting our ability, enough to sort of add features or maintain it, that I can't justify going back and fixing the architecture. I've learned from that. I've learned from my mistakes, and we won't make them going forward, but it always comes down to what the business case is.
But is that something that you have developed over time, say, moving from a standalone engineer to an architect, now yeah. more towards a business? Because your perspective has to change to some degree.
Oh, yeah. It has changed quite a bit. I mean, I don't think I was ever a purist. I definitely, you know, think I've always been a pragmatist when it comes to developing software. But my knowledge has increased dramatically over yeah. that time. And so now I have the perspective to look back and say, you know what? You know, this tightly coupled code is really hard to maintain going forward. Or even more importantly, and this is something that, you know, we've been grappling with here quite a bit over the last few years as the development team has grown substantially, is the idea of having as much automated testing as possible. I mean, we're dealing with patient, you know, safety issues in many cases when we're writing our software. And so when you're dealing with that kind of stuff, you absolutely need a robust set of automated testing in place. And a lot of the architectures I've used in the past simply aren't compatible with that. And it would take an enormous amount of time to go back there and fix it. And so I'm never making those choices again going forward, even if it takes longer now. You know, now the business case is we cannot in any way afford to have a patient safety issue in a piece of software that we release. We have to do everything we can to avoid that because the consequences are much more than just, you know, lost revenue. So definitely my perspective has changed, but I still say I try to do my best to balance the sort of pragmatic aspects of the job with the desire to have, you know, legit or clean or whatever you want to call code.
You mentioned that the company has grown quite significantly. So that was the next thing I wanted to ask you about. From, let's say, a technology perspective, how do you handle the growth from one developer to where you are now?
In many cases, it's just as much an architectural question as it is a sort of process or tools question. So when you're one developer, you know, source control helps, and I would never go without it. But that's pretty much all you need. I mean, the process involved with one developer is there doesn't need to be a ton of tools for collaboration. There doesn't need to be a ton of tools for automated testing, in my opinion, unless you're releasing some sort of critical piece of software. Because if you can fit all of the code in one person's head, you can get a ton of stuff done, and you can get it done really quick.
And there's no arguments.
Yeah. And you pretty much know exactly, you know, what you need to test and how you need to test it, and it's, you know, it's as rapid a form as development as possible.
It is.
Add one more developer to that? All right, so we need some collaboration in terms of maybe work item tracking, probably not, but you know, you can get away with yelling at the dude across the room and the arguments are still going to be there, but for the most part, you can probably still get away with that architecture where testing is very much of a manual process, so you can have a somewhat tightly coupled architecture, and you can probably still get away with it, and you can probably write code faster and get the stuff out the door faster. Without sort of going the solid route or the, you know, the loosely coupled route, which does usually take more time. Once you hit that kind of 3, 4, 5 developer range, especially if the developers have significantly varying skill levels, all of a sudden the game completely changes. So at that point is the point in which, and this is the exact evolution we went through, that's the point at which you start doing much, much more automated testing, because in order to bring on a new dev, they're going to be terrified to touch any code because they don't know what breaks and what doesn't break, and they don't know what affects what. I mean, no matter how good of a developer you are, if you're being introduced into a new code base, there's no way you're going to be able to sort of visualize all the interactions that might happen, like somebody who's written the code to begin with. So you need those automated, you know, tests in place, in order to make sure that they can change code, they can run an automated test suite, and they know they didn't break anything, or hopefully they didn't break anything. So getting that kind of infrastructure in place along with things like continuous integration, ideally continuous deployment, if not to a production environment, certainly to kind of staging and QA environments, that becomes super critical, because it allows you to bring on new developers more quickly.
then I know Galen has multiple offices, mainly Massachusetts, but also one other?
No, we have Boston, our Boston office. We have an office in Burlington, Vermont.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I thought Burlington, it was Burlington.
Vermont, and then we have an office in Chicago. So we've got developers to all three of those offices.
So was obviously that wasn't how it started.
No.
But is that something that evolved through necessity, or was it inability to hire developers locally, people moving?
Yeah, so in all of the initial hires, Galen actually breaks out its software development into custom programming, where we're kind of doing contract programming for our customers to fill a gap, and our products team, we're actually making resaleable products. And so all of the product development up until recently has been completely centered in Boston. And so it's only been in the last year or so that we've really had an issue with sort of collaboration between offices. Mm. Which has been quite the challenge.
And this is a small team still.
And this is still a small team.
Yes. And you're in similar enough time zones too.
Yeah, well that's a huge help. I mean, we're only an hour away from the Chicago office. So basically, in my experience, the primary roadblock for that kind of distributed development model is honestly the lack of a shared whiteboard. I mean, it's unbelievable how much of a difference. So, I mean, this is how we do, you know, development. This is how we plan for development, at least. We all get together in the room during our sprint planning sessions or sometimes during kind of architectural discussions. We have a multitude of whiteboards, and any one of the team members might get up and start scrawling out an idea by, you know, loosely drawing out some ideas on the whiteboard in terms of flow diagrams or what have you. And if the people can't see that and can't participate in that, it's really hard to communicate some of these abstract ideas. Mm-hmm. Now, there's other ways to do it. You know, you could do kind of a sort of a tablet pen type interface, but that simply doesn't work as well. Mm-hmm. There's some really neat digital whiteboards that we're actually probably going to be investing in, I hope, soon, mm-hmm. That allow you to have the same kind of experience in multiple places simultaneously in terms of collaborating on a whiteboard. But that's been our biggest issue in terms of a shared environment. It hasn't been, you know, coordinating work or, you know, having multiple people in physical different places working on the same files. You know, you can always kind of organize your project in a way that won't happen. It's really just those initial planning sessions where it's difficult. There's always the chance you're going to have certain members of the team get a little bit less engaged because they're not physically in the room with the rest of the team. And you can kind of solve that with, you know, we use a Surface tablet and we bring up Skype or Link or what have you and have every person that's remote, we have one of their sort of floating heads somewhere in the room. We've even gone as far as drawing out a body and putting it on a podium so that person can feel like they're in the same room with you. It's kind of a poor man's video conferencing system. And that helps, and that helps with engagement, but it really doesn't help a whole lot with the sort of more technical aspects of that collaboration. And that's what's come down to it comes down to the whiteboard, really.
So do you look at just flying the people in occasionally?
Yeah, we do that. So we have, if we're starting a new sort of big new project, we'll definitely have everybody in one place at one time. But economically, that just doesn't scale to do it on a frequent basis. You know, we do 2-week sprints, so having somebody come in for every sprint planning session is not going to be viable. The other way to do it is as your team grows, and this is when we're basically getting to this point now, is right now the whole team works on one thing at a time. Like, the whole team is working on a sprint for one of our products. And so we're all focused on that. And that means collaboration is important. But once you have a large enough team in different geographic areas, then you can have them start focusing on multiple products simultaneously. It doesn't work for every company. If you don't have multiple products, that's a problem. But at least if your product is big enough, you can have each team focus on different aspects of that product, different areas of the product. And then you can delegate that planning and collaboration to those people. And, you know, you might have a typical structure might be a team lead would then report to the architect. And so you'd have a team lead for each of those groups reporting to the architect to do any kind of, you know, last-minute collaboration or checks on the architecture. So that usually works, and that way you don't have to worry about shared whiteboard sessions for the most part, at least not as frequently. So that's one way to do it.
Another thing I've seen with technology departments as they grow, the very experienced engineers tend to get promoted and tend to move away from the software.
Yeah.
Has that happened to you?
It just did.
So now, are you more hands-off with the software, the architecture?
I've been growing more hands-off. I still probably spend, I would say, conservatively half my time coding now, which is
great.
That's
a lot.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy. And that's been a conscious decision on my part, and I've been given the freedom to do that, which is great. We're actually, as an organization, grappling with that idea right now, and how to, you know, avoid the Peter principle, where people are promoted. The idea of the Peter principle is that you're, you might be very, very good at a particular role, and so in order to reward you, you're promoted to a new role. That new role likely has new responsibilities, typically managerial-related responsibilities. You may or may not be a good manager. Mm. That's often unrelated to whether you're technically good at a job. And so eventually, you're promoted to the maximum level of your own incompetence. And then you're stuck. And so hopefully that didn't just happen to me. I'm hoping that didn't happen. We'll find out, I guess. But one of the ways to avoid that, and this is something that, that Galen is in the process of implementing, is the idea of having multiple tracks. So you have a technical track and you have a managerial track. And some very good technical people will go up the managerial track, but the goal is that the people on the technical side of things will be equal in every way, from a pay point of view, from a responsibilities point of view, and I think most importantly for many people, from a say point of view, from a seat at the table point of view. So you'd have we haven't come up with the names yet, but you have a senior architect, for instance, or a, whatever you want to call it, a technical fellow, to use Microsoft's term, would be at the exact same level as a director, or a vice president, or what have you. And so, there would be no reason for somebody to expect to be promoted into a managerial position unless they were good at that, because in every way those technical positions are equal and important.
Yeah, that is a problem a lot of companies have. In some of the companies I've worked for, the only way up was out of your primary skill, the thing you've been doing for 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
But in your own scenario now, are you finding that you have to delegate? And when you do, if you disagree with the person, do you override them, or do you say, you know what? It's really down to an opinion at this point. His view is one thing. We're both right. How do you deal with that?
Well, the makeup of the team right now is several senior-level people, a few mid-level people, and a bunch of junior-level people. And so I don't think luckily or unluckily, depending on how you look at it, I don't think I'm quite at the point where I have to worry about sort of that level of conflict. It's been mostly I'm still acting as the kind of chief architect. I'm the one who's kind of coming up with the best practices. But more and more I am kind of letting go of the reins and letting our senior people make these types of decisions, as long as I don't kind of vehemently disagree with them for some reason. But that's one key aspect of the culture here, I think, and this will vary from company to company. The culture here is very much a culture where if you've got a good argument for something, you're going to eventually win. You know, there is no real sort of ironclad hierarchy. It's a very collaborative process across the board. So if, you know, one of the guys that I manage comes to me and says, I want to do it this way and I disagree, we'll argue it out. And in fact, we'll usually argue it out in front of the whole team and get input from everybody. And then we'll come to a decision typically as a team, unless I still really, really disagree with them. But pretty much that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So it's a very collaborative environment. And I think that's, you know, pretty beneficial to the team.
Something we were discussing earlier was that Galen uses a very significant mixture of technologies.
Yeah.
Is that something that is driven by yourself, the available internal skills, or the demands of multiple customers?
All of the above. I mean, some of our products are deployed on-site, on-premises, in the data centers that are run by our customers, and typically within the infrastructure that have been dictated by the EMR vendor in question. So typically EMR vendors have strict guidelines about how their data centers are supposed to look. EMR means electronic medical record vendor. So the big ones out there are like Epic and Allscripts and Cerner and these large companies. And so oftentimes the technologies we're deploying to customers are dictated actually by those vendors.
Mm.
We're not going to go and deploy a sort of a Java-based server in an Allscripts environment, because Allscripts is 100% Microsoft, for instance. All of their technology stack is Microsoft. And that would be very foreign to the people that would typically maintain these environments, because they're hired to maintain a Microsoft environment. So in some ways, the technology choices are dictated by that. But a lot of our products are cloud-based, are sort of hosted by us. And in those cases, we are influenced heavily by team members, by skill sets internally, which is one of the reasons why we have a relatively heavy technology stack on Microsoft, because we have a lot of people that are familiar with Microsoft. That's typically how we've hired. A lot of our business up until recently has been in the Allscripts space, and that's a Microsoft stack. So that's really influenced that quite a bit. But we venture off that when we see fit. You know, we use, for instance, RavenDB instead of SQL Server for a few things, because RavenDB's feature set just matched what we were trying to do better. When we were choosing a cloud vendor, for instance, to host a lot of our stuff, we evaluated Amazon, we evaluated Rackspace, we evaluated Azure. Part of the reason we went Azure was that we had some experience. I had some experience personally at my previous job, sort of at the beginnings of the sort of Azure rollout, and you know, using it to a small extent then, and that influenced me going forward. But we did a full kind of technical evaluation of each one, and chose Microsoft because it turned out to be the best option, not necessarily because it was what we were comfortable with. Mm. And we try to make sure we do that with any kind of big technology chunk. We try to make sure we do a good, proof of concept for each of the different technologies. We try to make sure we, you know, do pros and cons and debate it amongst the team.
What was it specifically that led you to Azure as opposed to the other ones, if I may ask?
Honestly, it was mostly the concept of cloud services. The other cloud vendors more or less are, I mean, they have their infrastructure services. Amazon has their infrastructure mm. services, so does Rackspace. And actually, Rackspace has moved more towards the Azure model. But the idea that I can package up an application and deploy it and have them manage the kind of spawning of resources as needed and manage that whole network infrastructure layout for me without me having to worry about, you know, server maintenance or, you know, networking for the most part or anything like that, that was really appealing. And at the time we made a lot of these choices, that Amazon, or excuse me, Microsoft is pretty much the only game in town to do that. The model for most of these other cloud vendors are, you know, you can very easily provision new virtual machines and we'll give you plenty of templates to do that and yada yada, but there's still essentially machines in the cloud that you're connecting to via a terminal or via a remote desktop or what have you, and you're still essentially configuring them in the way you configure an on-premises machine. Whereas Azure's approach was a little bit more, I'm going to give you a platform on which you can develop a service, and as long as you adhere to a few rules, we'll make sure it scales the way it should. We'll make sure that you can handle the traffic the way you need to handle the traffic, and that was really appealing. Mm.
With regard to evaluating technologies and the like, do you tend to keep up with what Microsoft releases? So MVC 4 to MVC 5, mm-hmm. Web API 1 to Web API 2, but do you do this based on a need or just to stay current?
A little bit of both. Honestly, in that case, it really depends on whether or not this is being pushed to an on-premises deployment or whether we're doing our own hosting. If it's our own hosting, we're much, much more likely to just move up for the sake of moving up, mm-hmm. especially if there's, you know, I mean, typically there'll be nice features that we want to take advantage of. But we're much more willing to do that because we more or less control the environment and we know what kind of effect that'll have. Whereas if we're deploying to on-premises, to give you an example, I would love to move to, you know, MVC 5.1. 5.1 requires .NET 4.5.1. .NET 4.5.1 is not really supported in a lot of the environments that we might be deploying this to. Mm. They simply don't certify that for those environments. And because we piggyback on those environments, that's made our choice for us. But for the most part, we do try to move to the latest and greatest, especially when it comes to the tooling. Mm. We're, Galen as a company and all of our developers are almost always up on the new version of Visual Studio, for instance, within like 2, 3, 4 weeks of it being released, almost always. There's got to be a good reason not to, like broken dependencies on some third-party tool we use.
But you mentioned earlier that you have very serious software and people's lives somewhat depend on this.
Yeah.
So when you move from, let's say, Web API 1 to 2, mm-hmm. do you have to go and do incredibly heavy regression at that point, or have you already got that in place?
That's for the most part in place on the products where that's important. And that's what allows us to do this kind of moving up the chain in terms of technology. To some extent, you can kind of be confident, you know, Microsoft's pretty good about regression testing their platforms. Mm. You know, they're usually very good about giving you a list of breaking changes. Usually when something breaks, it breaks badly. And so you can kind of see, you know it pretty quick. Yeah. You know, we did run into one kind of interesting problem a while back where, I don't remember exactly. I think this was the transition from .NET 3.5 to .NET 4.0 and some of the code access security changes specifically related to RDLC, the Microsoft reporting services local client library where you can, they have an RDLC file type, which is like an XML file type that you can define your reports in. And they're basically compiled on they take the XML and they compile it on the fly into essentially a DLL. And because of some of the code access security changes, It forced, and because of, I think, a bug related to a memory leak, it forced the compilation to push it off into a new app domain from the app domain that you were currently running in. So every time you ran an RDLC file, it was actually running it in a new app domain, and it used remoting to communicate back and forth. That was a massive change that was poorly documented between the versions. So when we upgraded to .NET 4 for this particular product, and we upgraded to the latest version of RDLC, all hell broke loose. And that was an example of, we didn't have an automated test in place. It wasn't a patient safety issue. It was basically our whole system just exploded issue. And it wasn't like we were returning the wrong information for a patient or something. And this particular system wasn't relied on for day-to-day clinical operations. So it didn't end up being a disaster like it could have been. But there's an example where you really, really do need to have automated testing in place for a lot of these systems, because we didn't catch it until we had actually started deploying. You didn't see it under small amounts of load. You only saw it under heavy amounts of load, and then things came crashing down. So
that is very hard. That is one of those tricky scenarios.
Yeah, it really is.
Same kind of topic, replacing working old stuff with the new version.
Yeah.
Is that something that you do, or do you just leave it?
It depends on the effort involved. Mm. We have one of our products has a code base that's 1 million+ lines of code. And the chance we're going to go back in and gut any kind of major piece of technology in that is pretty slim. The smaller the code base, the more likely we are to do that. And oftentimes it comes down to, you know, is there some specific feature in that new, platform or dependency or whatever it is that you really, really want to use? And if you can justify it, and if you can kind of measure the impact, then we'll do it. And sometimes it comes down to, can we get it done in a sprint? You know, if we're moving from, for instance, Web API 1 to 2 because we want to use attribute routing, which is actually exactly why we did it, can we get that migration done all in one sprint with the available resources we have? Because that's going to be something that's going to be hard to spread across multiple sprints unless you want to branch and have people working just on that, in a side branch so that they can do development in parallel to what you're doing, which is something we try to avoid. So if I can get it done in a sprint, then we're going to do it. Typically, if it can be justified by the feature we're looking for.
Reusability has come up a few times in our discussion. Obviously, with such a large code base, I presume you're aiming for as much reusability as possible.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, a lot of it has to do with the sort of skill set of the developers you're working with. You have to balance the desire for reusability with your developers' abilities to produce that reusability. You know, it takes a lot of experience, in my opinion, independent of the concept of solid programming. It takes a lot of experience to know how to write something in a reusable way. You know, there's a tendency, especially for junior developers, to write something that does everything they need to do all in one big method or all in one class because it's convenient, it's easy, it makes it easy to understand and look at, and oftentimes it gets the job done, and it makes it very unreusable, but you're not going to find that out until you try to reuse it, typically. So for the most part, there's a lot of code review that goes on that tries to educate developers about the best way to kind of break these things up. Solid goes into that quite a bit. You know, that kind of forces you, especially the dependency injection side of things, or rather the inversion of control side of things, that kind of forces you to make things modular and reusable, just because that, you know, you're not, if you've got a constructor with, you know, 30 interfaces you're passing into it, you probably did something wrong.
There's a bit of a problem here, yes.
and honestly, that problem would be completely hidden if you weren't using, you know, some kind of dependency injection. And so those solid principles kind of force you to write code the right way. Otherwise, you see something that obviously doesn't look right. And that's something that a junior developer can pick up. A junior developer, just like any other developer, is going to see a constructor with 30 dependencies and say, maybe I did something wrong. Whereas they might not see it if, you know, they were trying to break up the class in a way that could be used from, you know, back-end code and front-end code in a lot of different places. That's something they're only going to get with experience, whereas this, they kind of get it just, it's kind of built into you that something shouldn't take in 30 arguments. At least most people.
I would agree. Other thing I've seen is massive static classes that achieve everything.
God classes, yes.
And they then throw in some extension methods too, just because you can.
Yeah, why not? Sure, throw it in there. Yep, there's plenty of those code smells. We've tried to use static analysis tools to help us, you know, pick those things out, but there's so many false positives and you have to spend so much time configuring those tools. I haven't been able to justify that yet. You know, maybe when the team gets bigger and bigger, you know, maybe when we're at 30 or 40 developers, that'll make more sense. But right now, it's mostly a process of code review and just developer education to try to encourage that reusable patterns.
So testing is something you've mentioned a few times. Can you tell me what your approach is?
Well, it depends on what product we're talking about. So some of our older products have very, very little automated testing. We've tried to kind of retrofit UI-level testing on top of that, things like coded UI. That works okay, depending on the UI mechanism we're using to deliver. So if it's a WinForm app versus a, you know, a web page, a lot of our older code, especially the stuff we wrote, say, pre-2011 or 12, is web form code in terms of web-based interfaces, and that tends to be more difficult to do automated testing on from a UI perspective because of the wonderful hierarchy of control IDs and things like that. MVC is much easier in that respect. So older code, we tend to take the approach of let's try to retrofit it with UI-level testing and get the job done that way, because fixing the code to make it truly testable would be a monumental effort. Essentially, at this point, for a lot of this older code, for this legacy code, it's almost a total rewrite. And you can't really justify that from a business point of view for a product that works and it delivers what it needs to deliver. For the newer code, we definitely take the approach of, you know, we have unit testing that's as isolated as possible, thanks to things like dependency injection and interception and that kind of good stuff. We probably have more integration level testing than most companies have. I'm a big believer in that you haven't really tested your system unless you've done a real big integration test, or even sort of a system level test where you're just, or some people call it subsurface testing, where you're just below the surface of the UI. So you're in the controller, or you're in your, you know, whatever you're using for your Ripple layer, presentation layer in a WinForm or what have you. If you can test at that level and you can test business scenarios at that level, those are super valuable tests. You need a lot of infrastructure to make that happen. A lot of these tests will require a sort of continuous integration and deployment environment, which is a lot of work to get set up. But once you have that set up, those tests are super, super valuable. So I believe in like feature level testing, where I'm saying, all right, I want to test logging into the application. What are the scenarios used to log into an application? Let's test those. And that lends really nicely into tools like SpecFlow, where you can define, I like calling this, you know, it's behavior-driven design or behavior-driven development. I actually like calling it business-driven development, where it's not a technical person in many cases that's writing out the gherkin or writing out the business case, the test case. It's a product manager or it's a, you know, a business analyst that's doing it, saying this is what the feature needs to be. And then that can be translated into either unit tests, although more oftentimes it's at, you know, your best scenario is an integration level test or a subservice test for those types of high level descriptions of functionality. And if those tests are passing, yes, you can still have bugs. And yes, those bugs could get caught by unit testing, but it's pretty unlikely. Whereas on the flip side, when you're doing very heavy levels of unit testing, some code lends itself awesome to unit testing. Like, we have a product that is an integrated health calculator product, and it does things like calculate your risk for heart attack based on, you know, your family history and your cholesterol and your all these different things. And the formula to do that is a well-known formula. There's plenty of reference sort of calculators you can use to determine if your function is giving you the correct answer. And that code is very isolated all by itself. You know, it's just, it gets some inputs and it gives you an output, and you don't have to connect to a database, you don't have to go and hit a web service, it's just, you know, it's C# code. And so it's already nicely isolated, and that is perfect for unit testing. We unit test the hell out of that stuff. And so there's scenarios where, let's say your code is retrieving things from a database using Entity Framework. You could wrap that Entity Framework code in, you know, a repository pattern and really hide a lot of the functionality of your ORM. And a lot of people do that. In fact, that's kind of the going popular design pattern. I hate that design pattern.
There's a lot of discussion about that. I think I've seen articles by Julie Lerman where she says EF is already a repository. Why do you have to do this?
And that's easy to say now, especially with the later versions of Entity Framework, where they've made it a hell of a lot easier to mock up your context classes. But for a long time, that was really difficult. And so people would wrap a lot of this functionality inside of a repository pattern. And then the way you test it is you'd have I repository of whatever, and you could just fill it with some fake data, but you're not really testing that at that point. You can get unit tests out of that, and that works great, but oftentimes these entity framework queries need, not oftentimes, always, they need to translate that eventually into SQL, and that translation process can very easily fail, and the only thing that's going to catch that isn't the unit test, which is just giving you fake stuff out of memory, it's the integration test. So it's introducing that abstraction on top of your ORM introduces a whole bunch of other issues you have to deal with, and so I tend to avoid that. I'd much rather try to mock up the ORM itself, and that's harder in many cases. You have to do a lot of work in some cases to get that to happen, especially with things like, you know, if you want to include addition, you know, I can't remember exactly what the syntax is, but you can say, you know, give me this entity and also include this related entity. You know, that operation is, you can mock it up. It's somewhat difficult. It might take 20 or 30 lines of code to get that working properly. But it's worth it, in my opinion, because it prevents you from falling into the trap of thinking, oh, I've got a unit test that tests my interaction with a repository. So I've tested this code base. I'm pretty much good to go. No, not really. You haven't tested it until you've actually had it execute against a real database and done that translation. And you could argue, well, you're testing entity framework there. Well, no, you're not really. Entity framework knows that it can't do that, and it's been well tested. You're testing your usage of entity framework, which is important. And so we go through the trouble of setting up things like, for our integration tests that run on our continuous integration environment, we'll actually spin up a database from source control. You know, we source control all our database schema. We spin up that database, we'll load in test data, and then it'll be a local DB instance, and using the SQL Server 2012 local DB concept. We load that stuff in. It's a, you know, known set of data, and we execute against that local DB instance, and then we tear it down when it's done. And that's a much more legitimate, that's a much more legitimate integration test. You've tested exactly the way that thing's going to be run in a real life environment.
It's a proper execution.
It's a proper execution, and that's really, really important. But it takes a lot of infrastructure. I mean, a team with two guys, it's going to be hard to justify spending a couple of months getting that set up.
Yeah.
A team with 7, 8, 10 guys, it starts to make a lot of sense.
But you do, again, have life-changing potential mistakes.
Yes. That's another factor.
Yes. Yep. There is a level of seriousness about the software that you developed that a lot of engineers don't have to worry about.
That's true.
I mean, the biggest mistake, depending on the company you're in, maybe that the website's down for a little while, maybe that there's some lost revenue.
Yeah.
It's rare for us to have someone's life potentially damaged or worse.
Luckily, not all of our software is like that, but the stuff that is, we're careful.
Just to go back to SpecFlow for 1 second, was that something that you, do you use it with the mind that the business users will write? And has that worked out?
I originally investigated SpecFlow, and we're just sort of in the process of really getting into using this, but I originally investigated it with the idea that I wanted to use it to actually enable us to do automated testing on our legacy code base. So that million lines of code that we're not rewriting, we still want to be able to test it in some way or another. So doing UI level testing made a lot of sense, but there's a ton of work that goes into defining those UI level tests. And a lot of that work has to do with defining what it's supposed to do. The big problem with documentation, as I'm sure everybody knows, is that it gets out of date. The documentation that we have for this particular product is actually wiki-based, so it's pretty good, but it's relatively high level. It often doesn't go into the detail you need to actually do scenario type testing. So I wanted to come up with a way to scale out that effort. If I put it on just our test engineers, sure, they could do the research, contact the business people, try to figure out exactly how this is supposed to work, but unless they're one of the people that originally wrote it, which is just a couple engineers, it's going to take them forever to figure out exactly the behavior that they want. So I wanted to scale out that process of defining those requirements in a way that could be translated into the plumbing, the test plumbing, the end unit test plumbing in this case, that could be used and could be filled in by the test engineer. So now the test engineer doesn't have to guess as to the way the software is supposed to behave. And honestly, that's where a lot of the work comes in is, you know, it could take, you know, something as simple as a login process, all of the idiosyncrasies of a login process might take you the better part of a day to figure out. If that's already been done for you ahead of time and all you have to do is verify that these, you know, XYZ steps execute as expected, that saves a ton of time. And you've successfully taken something, you know, a code base that might take a week to automate, or, you know, some subset of a code base might take a week to do UI level automation. You've now been able to spread that work across, instead of one person, maybe two, three, four people, and you're able to use the resources you have available to you.
And the business user is much closer to the product, uses it every day, right. interacts with the end customers, knows how they use it.
Right.
Because oftentimes engineers, we know the right way to use something.
Right.
We certainly don't know the wrong way.
Right. All the good bugs get found when the business users start using it. So that was the goal behind SpecFlow. And you know, we're still in the early phases of that. We're really starting to ramp up in terms of getting some of our legacy code at least somewhat tested. And it's working pretty well, and that scalability has just been, you know, it's allowed me to justify this time, because now I can leverage more resources than normally I would have been able to.
A couple of final things. You've given me a list of books that you found very helpful or influential. I'll include those with a post about this. But do you have any general advice for engineers, let's say junior to mid-level?
I would say that my biggest piece of advice is every morning, or at least some point during the day, you should be hitting the you know, aggregation blogs. There's a handful of blogs out there that are pretty popular. Jason Haley is one of the big ones, obviously. Morning Brew and a handful of other ones, where those are specifically for .NET developers, but there's plenty of ones out there for Java developers and Ruby developers and everybody else. And basically, just make it a goal to skim through every single link on those blogs every single solitary day. Do it on two or three or four of those, just to make sure you get a good coverage of everything that's happening. Because the rate of change now for developers, at least in my opinion, is much, much faster than the rate of change when I started.
It's so hard to keep up.
It's almost impossible. Yeah. When I started, you know, especially if you were on the Microsoft stack, every couple of years there'd be a big release. Mm. And in between there, there'd be minor fixes, but you had a couple of years to catch up on whatever you're working on. Now, especially with some of the new methodologies that Microsoft's using for distributing updates in pretty much everybody, whether that's releasing, you know, decoupling their frameworks and releasing new features as NuGet packages or what have you, it is virtually impossible to keep apprised of all of them unless you make a concerted effort. I mean, I spend probably a solid hour every day just seeing what's new. Sometimes it doesn't take that long. Sometimes you'll read through the blogs and you're like, yep, I know that, whatever. Sometimes you'll say, well, wait a minute. You know, there's a half a dozen links here that I need to investigate. Mm. Save them off into your whatever tool you use to aggregate that stuff and keep up with them, because it's the only way you're going to stay relevant. You know, nobody wants a developer that is 5 years behind whatever the latest and greatest is. Even if they're not using whatever the latest and greatest is, that interview process is going to ask you what that latest and greatest is.
You better know. You need to be familiar.
Yeah, you really need to be familiar. So that's you know, my kind of primary advice, is just stay current and constantly read about that stuff.
Thank you very much, Bob Downey.
Yeah, thank you.